Looking for instant, long-lasting volume and texture? Meet
in celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary. This podcast is supported by Cartier.
Living Proof's Full Dry Volume Blast. Use the code VOLUME at livingproof.com for a free travel-size full dry volume blast with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/modernlove.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The 68th Annual Emmy Awards were on Sunday. Congratulations to all the nominees and winners. But if we may, we'd like to extend an even bigger congratulations to the Emmy winners who also put in award-worthy performances reading for Modern Love. So today, we thought we'd listen back to some of the essays they brought to life. We begin with Sarah Paulson. She won the Emmy for Best Actress in a Limited Series for her portrayal of Marcia Clark in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson, which, by the way, also won for Outstanding Limited Series. Here's Sarah Paulson on Emmy Night.
Now, the responsibility of playing a real person is an enormous one. You want to get it right, not for you, but for them. The more I learned about the real Marcia Clark, not the two-dimensional cardboard cutout I saw on the news, but the complicated, whip-smart, giant-hearted mother of two who woke up every day, put both feet on the floor, and dedicated herself to righting an unconscionable wrong, the loss of two innocents, Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown. The more I had to recognize that I, along with the rest of the world, had been superficial and careless in my judgment, and I'm glad to be able to stand here today in front of everyone and tell you I'm sorry.
For Modern Love, Sarah Paulson read Amy Seek's essay exploring the complex emotional terrain of adoption. It's called Open Adoption, Not So Simple Math. Here's an encore.
I wanted my son to become the kind of person who appreciates the beauty of the world around him. So I smiled when at six he asked to borrow my camera in case he saw something beautiful. We were taking a walk in the woods outside Boston, and following behind him, I was surprised by how much he moved like his father. We spent that afternoon showing each other icicles and hollow trees, breaking frozen patterns in the river ice, inching too close to the water to get a better view of the bridge above. When we arrived home, Ben said that the reason he wanted to go for a walk was to spend time with me. It had been 3 months since I last saw him. I smiled sheepishly and stepped into the living room, where the woman who had adopted him 6 years earlier sat reading the newspaper. I spent the evening chatting with her while avoiding direct interaction with Ben for fear I'd show too much affection or too little. Open adoption is an awkward choreography. I am offered a place at the table, but I am not sure where to sit. I don't know how to be any kind of mother, much less one who surrendered her child, but is back to help build a Lego castle. It is a far cry from the moment he was born, when my 23-year-old body seemed to know exactly what to do. When I suddenly and surprisingly wanted nothing more than to admire him nursing at my breast. When after a drugless labor, my surging hormones helped me to forget that I was a college student, that I lived in Cincinnati, that I was passionate about architecture. During those days, I was roused by the slightest sound of his lips smacking, innocent, newborn desire that offered my deepest fulfillment. In the months before I gave birth, when my boyfriend and I were just getting to know the couple we had chosen, I was able to comprehend the coming exchange only on the most theoretical of levels, but it seemed like gentle math. Girl with child she can't keep, plus woman who wants but can't have child. Balance the equation, and both parties become whole again. During those months, my son's mother, Holly, observed that birth mothers have to accomplish in one day the monumental task of letting go that most parents have 18 years to figure out. Days after his birth, when I struggled with letting go, Holly sat with me and cried. For the children she never got to have, for the fact that adoption would bring her joy while causing me pain, and out of fear she had already grown to love a child I might not give her. I decided to let her take him for a night to see if I could handle it. She drove him to Dayton, Ohio, where she was staying with family, and then called and asked, "Do you want him back? I'll bring him right now." Meanwhile, the men in our lives stood by and hoped for the best. My boyfriend supported the adoption, and though we had broken up, he was there to help me through my pregnancy. We had met in architecture school, never suspecting that 2 years later we would be forever joined as birth parents, composing 111 questions to ask strangers about the most intimate details of their lives. We had a list of qualities we wanted in a couple, basically ourselves, 10 years older. But when we met the couple we would choose, our list fell by the wayside, replaced by an overwhelming intuition that we could trust them. I signed the papers on a hot August day in 2000, sitting at a large conference table with my sister, my son's adoptive parents, and agents from Catholic Social Services. I'd sat there several times before, but hadn't yet been able to say words to relinquish all rights to my son. Every time I was left alone to think, and hours later, was sent home with him. My ex was not there. The birth had made me a different person, and we couldn't pretend that our losses would be the same. My sister had come from China, where she was teaching. She promised that if I kept him, she would move home and help. Her face was glazed in tears, but she stared intently at me as I prepared to sign the papers, as if to assure herself I knew what I was doing. My pen rested at the intersection of two vastly different futures, and I struggled to see into the distance of each. It did not seem that a gesture as small as scribbling my name had the power to set me down one path while turning the other, its entire landscape, to dust. It was such a small gesture, but it was the first sketch of my life without a son. One of the exercises I was given in adoption counseling was to envision the hours immediately after the adoption. What would I do after signing the papers? Pick up the towels that had been tossed in the corner when my water broke? Pack up the extra blankets I'd been given by the hospital workers who touched my shoulder and prayed aloud that I would find the courage to keep my son? I had spent my entire life without a child, but I was newly born that night too, and my old self disappeared. I could no longer imagine how a mother could give up a child and live. Adoption was not simple math. A new mother cannot know the value of the things she subtracts. It is only through time, when my son turned 4 and I was 27, when he turned 6 and I was 29, when he turns 10 this year and I am 33 and ready for children, that I begin to understand the magnitude of what I lost and that it is growing. The comfort is seeing my son with his family, whom I can no longer imagine him or myself without. He is an earnest child who seems to kick hard to keep his chin above water in the world, but his mother has a certain lack of sympathy that is good for him. When he wants to retreat into his own head, she pulls him back into the refuge of his family and makes him smile. I am ever astounded that I was able to see in her something that would still feel so right so many years later. The greatest proof of her commitment to openness is that she talks about me when I'm not there. When my son was a baby, I was surprised that he always remembered me, even after long stretches when I couldn't visit. When he was 7 and we were playing a computer game, he told me his password was Cincinnati because his mother had told him he was born there. I know that Holly represents me to my son in my absence and always encourages him to love me. Holly jokes that with open adoption, at least you know what the birth mother is doing, that she's busy at school and not conceiving a plot to steal her child back. It's not so with closed adoptions. The birth mother is powerfully absent. But an open process forces an adoptive parent to confront the pain that adoption is built on. An openness for Holly does not mean merely letting the birth mother know about her child. It means cultivating a real love between birth parents and child. This requires exceptional commitment, which may be why some open adoptions become closed in the end. I love Holly for sharing such things with me, sentiments that show she's devoted to our relationship, and not because it is easy for her. And I have told her that a pivotal point in my grief was the moment I was able to say aloud that I wanted my son back, though I knew it was impossible. When I realized that his adoption had been both my greatest accomplishment and deepest regret. And we continually redefine this relationship. I hide certain exchanges, like the time he was 4 and crawled into my arms and said, "Amy, pretend I'm your baby." I made sure no one was looking before I indulged his request, my entire body shuddering at the chance to hold him so close for the first time since birth. I suspect Holly knows about these moments, and when I visit, she tries to help by sending me off with my son for walks in the woods, where we can freely explore my place in his life. When I returned home to New York after my visit, I looked at the pictures Ben had taken with my camera. Fragments of arms and legs, blurry close-ups of leaves caught in ice, too many spinning forest skies. Evidence to me that although he has his father's distinctive gait, he shares my need to grasp and hold on to beautiful things, to document and to somehow preserve them forever. Things he can't possibly keep.
Sarah Paulson, reading Amy Seek's essay, Open Adoption, Not So Simple Math. We spoke to Amy about what it's been like to watch her son grow up from afar, and you can hear...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
That conversation at wbur.org/modernlove or by revisiting episode 3 on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back in just a minute.
Living Proof delivers bigger hair that lasts. Product tester Jamie explains what Full Dry Volume Blast does for her.
What they tested a lot on my hair was kind of the next day results. So they were looking for how long did this volume really stay? Once you applied it, did it fall flat in a few hours? And it really doesn't. In fact, in my hair, I think it looks better 24 hours after. It just, the hair held amazingly well and it was ready to go. It looked incredible.
Use the code VOLUME at livingproof.com for a free travel-size full-dry volume blast with your $20 order.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this week we're honoring Emmy winners who've performed on Modern Love. Next up, Tony Hale. He plays Gary Walsh, aide to President Selina Meyer on the HBO series Veep, which took home this year's Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series. Tony Hale showcased his comedic chops for us in his performance of Steve Friedman's essay, Just Friends? Let me read between the lines.
She dumped me. What's important are not the details, but the pronoun placement. She preceding me. But there's no villain here. My therapist suggests I repeat this mantra to myself. So I do. There is no villain here. There is no green-eyed, wasp-waisted, pillow-breasted, sneering queen-of-the-damn villain who dumped me so swiftly and with such imperious, frigid beauty that I experienced chest pains and shortness of breath, leading to something called a cardiolite stress test, which I just discovered my insurance company may not pay for, and which has left me not only miserable and lonely and occasionally sobbing in public bathrooms, but also about $6,000 in debt. But no one is to blame here. My therapist suggests I repeat this phrase too. No one is to blame here. Did she have her reasons? Could I have been a better boyfriend? Is it telling that I was 48 when we met and never married, that I had spent the better part of 3 decades shedding wedding happy sweethearts as a tailback dances away from fiendish linebackers? And that I had recently looked in the mirror and seen staring back male pattern baldness and the egregious folly of my broken field running brand of romance? Ha! No good can come from dwelling on such questions. So, let's assume she had her reasons. What's important is not what she did or why. What's important is how I handled it. Personal setbacks and romantic rejection, according to authorities ranging from the Dalai Lama to the editors of Cosmo Girl, offer us all opportunities to behave with grace and courage and self-respect. They also offer the opportunity to do what I did. First, a day after she dumped me, I sent an email message, an affectionate, graceful, non-desperate note of about 200 words that I worked on for 3 hours. I remember how wonderful and sweet things felt with you, I wrote. That was good, I thought. Bold, yet sensitive. From laughing and kissing on the tennis court to drifting in the ocean to holding each other and feeling so lucky and grateful. I just wanted to let you know that. It's not bad. Heartfelt, but not clinging. And then I wrote, and I wanted to own up to the toxic stuff I brought to the relationship and to tell you how much you mean to me and to acknowledge the enormous amount of effort and kindness and love you brought to me and to our relationship. I wanted her back so bad it gave me a stomach ache. But I remembered with distress the time she had accused me of whining. I struggled over the last line for 20 minutes. I decided on, write back if you want, but you don't need to feel obliged. She didn't feel obliged, which made me want to call her, which made me want to have sex with her, which made me want to wake up next to her to grow old with her or to see her age and grow fat and ugly very quickly. She's dead to me, I told my friends. I was mentally ill to have dated her, I told my friends. Obviously a borderline personality, I told my friends. Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had? I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back. A week later, I received an email message. She thanked me for mine, apologized for not getting back to me sooner, admitted she was sad about how things had ended. Then came the key line. I just hope we can have some sort of friendship going forward. Ho, 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 ho! I decided this was her way of widening the dialogue. I decided this was her way of signaling that she was open to romance. I decided to ignore the advice of every single one of my friends, not to mention my therapist. I telephoned her and suggested we try again. She laughed. I persisted. She might have used the phrase just friends, but I have not been able to locate those words in the detailed notes I kept of our conversation. Besides, are the details really that important, huh? Didn't the fact that we had loved each other unconditionally and fully and intensely for 4 weeks and 3 days and 9 hours and 26 and a half minutes mean more than mere words? We made a date to see a movie. On the afternoon of, she canceled, pleading fatigue and an impending sore throat. She said she would rather make it another night. Was that okay? But of course it was okay. I'm an adult, after all, not a child. I'm not a child. She couldn't possibly suspect that I would be bothered by a postponed date, could she? Or hurt, suspicious, or deeply wounded, or reminded with a throbbing emptiness in my gut and sticking pain behind my eyes that when we were making out on tennis courts and drifting in ocean currents and discussing plans to hike in New Zealand together and holding each other in bed, nothing like a sore throat, excuse me, an impending sore throat, would ever keep us apart. Feel better, I offered majestically. Call her right when you're on the mend and we'll celebrate your return to health, I suggested. Manfully, powerfully, with confidence, no neediness there, no rage, no desperate cardiolite test-inducing words. Almost a week later on my birthday, as I was finishing a magazine profile, I received another email note. Hope you're having a V special day. Is the story done? XOXO. Oh. I spent that afternoon and evening deconstructing the text. 2 lines, not good. 11 words on my birthday, not good. The V instead of very, not so good. But perhaps I was misreading. Perhaps I was bringing my own insecurities to bear on a sweet, loving signal from cyberspace. I cross-referenced her word usage with all her other email, which I had saved in a special file, and made a startling discovery. She had used the V abbreviation before. Obviously, it was a literary affectation or just a communicative tic. I had been entirely too eager to see it in proof of withered feelings. And it would be blind and horribly unfair, would it not, to ignore the XO, a clear, unambiguous indication that she was ready to drift with me in the ocean currents again? Huh? I called her to clear things up. I didn't want to misunderstand her, I said. Did she want to date or not? She suggested I not call again. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah? Well, then I suggested she not call again and that she lose my email address. And furthermore, if she ever saw me on the street, she had better... She hung up. Oh, I stewed. I composed bitter letters about how she was incapable of love, how she didn't recognize the gifts I had given her. I did not send the letters. Thank you, 10 years of therapy. I drifted through the photos of her in my computerized slideshow, accompanied by Rebecca Luker singing Till There Was You over and over and over again. I lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks. Then, a blinding epiphany. I shouldn't have snapped at her on the phone. Of course she had recoiled. Who wouldn't? With the insight came a great sense of calm. With the calm, a sense of hope. With the hope, a plan. If I made her understand how much I loved her, how I in no way blamed her, and how I had changed and was now neither needy nor angry, but just a man filled with love and affection and magnificent intentions, then she might take me back, and we could get back to the ocean currents and tennis courts. This time I stayed away from the phone. Spoken language was so easily misconstrued. I'm sorry, I wrote. I'm really, really sorry. Then I elaborated. You have no idea how sorry I am. Other literary high points included, I was such an idiot. You don't know how much I miss you. I wish you'd give us another chance on whatever terms you want. A week later, she wrote back. She appreciated the apology. She didn't trust me. She wished me well. Didn't trust me. No wonder she didn't want us to travel in New Zealand together. Surely if she knew about the chest pains and shortness of breath, her doubts about my sincerity would vanish. Surely if I told her about the way I listened to the Music Man while mooning over her digital photos, she would come back. So I did. I told her. One more email message. I told her all that. I also cited lines from Casablanca and Malcolm in the Middle. I mentioned my prayers. That was almost a month ago. In that time, I've reflected on and marveled at the chilly and dignified silence that has been maintained by the women I myself have dumped over the years. I have thought of the pathetic old professor in The Blue Angel who Marlene Dietrich compels to cluck like a chicken, of the poor bastard in Endless Love, of every mopey mope whom Frank Sinatra immortalized in his greatest loser anthems. I've considered the Dalai Lama and Cosmo Girl way of life and realized that I behaved with all the dignity of a furious and heartsick and grievously wronged Teletubby. But I'm getting better. And finally getting it.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
I know this because 2 weeks ago, for the first time in a long time, when a woman smiled in my direction on the subway, possibilities occurred to me. I know this because for the first time in a long time, I'm not racing to check my email every day or gazing at photos of her. I haven't destroyed those photos or the letters and email, as friends have advised, but I don't need to. This time she's really dead to me. Really. I mean it.
Tony Hale, reading Steve Friedman's essay, Just Friends? Let Me Read Between the Lines. Steve has now had 12 years to get over this breakup. Has he done it? You can listen to episode 28 to find out. There's more Modern Love Emmy talent after the break.
Support for Modern Love comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using your phone or tablet, you can safely share your bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It just takes a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/modernlove. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
And we're back, and we've got one more Modern Love essay brought to life by an Emmy winner. The morning after this year's awards show, Slate posted this headline. Congratulations to the Emmys for correctly giving the Best Supporting Actor Award to Sterling K. Brown.
Thank you to the Academy. A lot of you may not have known who I was, but you checked the box anyway. And that makes me very, very happy. To the communities that have supported me up to this point in my career, there's a lot of people in St. Louis making a lot of noise right now. Mama, I can hear you. I love you. Sterling Brown Jr., I changed what people called me to age 16 so I could hear your name every day of my life. I love you, Daddy.
Brown won his first Emmy for his portrayal of Christopher Darden in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Brown chooses his roles carefully, and he selected an especially poignant essay to read for Modern Love. Here's Sterling K. Brown with David Lovsa's essay, My First Son, A Pure Memory.
Having waited until we were in our 30s to start a family, my wife and I were having trouble conceiving, leading the sperm tests, hormone shots, and other extraordinary measures. Over many months, the process of conception became so technical that when Lisa told me she was at last pregnant, I found it hard to know what to credit. After the first ultrasound, she came home with a black and white picture of a tiny, curled-up creature. We put it on the refrigerator. My son, the lima bean. At 20 weeks, we went in together for the second ultrasound. The technician made small talk and popped his gum as he dimmed the lights. Lisa lay back on the table. I shifted in my seat, jammed my hands into my pockets, and stretched out my legs like a teenager settling in to watch a movie. As the technician slid the paddle around on Lisa's belly, the image on the computer screen wheeled, dipped, and blurred. Finally, my son's image popped into focus. Arms and legs folded, he seemed to be resting on his back, as if lying on the bottom of a pool, waiting to spring to the surface. The technician muttered something, hit a button to freeze the image, and walked briskly out of the room. A few minutes later, in walked a small man wearing a rumpled white coat and steel-rimmed glasses, his bow tie askew. He shut the door behind him. I don't remember exactly what he said. He looked as if someone had left him out in the rain. What we had taken for a frozen image, he explained, was in fact absolute stillness. We still referred to the man as Dr. Death. Always sad, always breaking bad news. They keep him in a closet somewhere. A year later, pregnant with our second son, Benjamin, my wife turned a corner at the hospital and saw him at a nurse's station. She did an abrupt, involuntary about-face. After Dr. Death left, our midwife arrived to explain that we had a decision to make. Did we want to schedule a D&C, or did we want to induce labor? Her language was very plain, but it took a while for me to understand what she was really asking. Did we want the pregnancy to end in a surgical procedure in the outpatient clinic, or in the maternity ward as a stillbirth? We asked whether there were medical advantages or disadvantages to either choice. She told us it was simply a matter of preference. No hurry. Let us know. On the drive home, we were mostly silent. As if exchanging telegrams, Lisa and I said what we needed to and no more. We each assumed there was only one possible decision, so when we talked logistics, appointments to reschedule, job responsibilities to manage. We asked questions we might have asked the midwife about recovery time. Then we realized we weren't in agreement. I was talking about the DNC, while Lisa had decided to give birth. Incredulous, I asked why she would want to go through all that pain. She said she couldn't imagine just getting rid of our child by a surgical procedure. She wanted to see him. So I had to ask myself, why didn't I want to meet my own son? We pulled into the driveway, phoned the hospital, turned around and drove back. Going to the hospital for a stillbirth is the photographic negative of going for a live birth. You carry the overnight bag, check into a room in the maternity ward and so on, but they put a marker on your door to alert the nurse midwives that in this room, things are different. As a means of inducing labor in a body that is not yet ripe, Pitocin is brutally effective, but it can take a while to kick in. After an hour of flipping through magazines, Lisa and I decided to take a walk. The nurse said it might speed things along. Wandering about in the midwinter dusk, Seattle sinking to the bottom of the gray scale, we were about a quarter mile from the hospital, just about to turn around when the drug took hold, doubling Lisa over. We considered calling a cab, but she decided she could make it, so we stumbled back with her arm around my shoulders for support. By the time we reached Lisa's room, her contractions were frequent and prolonged, much more so than they would have been at the early stages of a natural labor, and each surge of pain seemed to levitate her body above the sheets. When at last the anesthesiologist gave her an epidural, Lisa sighed and fell back into the pillows. Within an hour, she was asleep, and shortly after that, I dozed off as well, like a lab curled up in an armchair at the foot of her bed. My first son was born sometime in the gray dawn. In such cases, there's no rupturing of waters. The birth sac slips out whole and unbroken. The bag was a little bigger than my fist. The midwife put it on a towel and, with a small pair of scissors, carefully snipped it open. She unfolded our son's limbs, disentangling one from the other, unfurling him like a new leaf, talking softly to us all the while, describing him. He was about 5 inches long, she said. He was anencephalic, which means his brain and nervous system had failed to develop. He had probably died about a week earlier. Gingerly, she handed him to Lisa, and though it was clear that Lisa wanted to hold him longer, it was only a minute or two before she passed him to me. Later, Lisa told me she was afraid he would come apart in her hands. Resting on my outstretched hand, he was thin, nearly weightless, his skin pinkish-gray and translucent. He seemed to me less like a small baby than a scale model of a stripling child. I cradled his head between the ends of my middle and ring fingers, his features peaceful, perfect, blank. His feet reaching nearly to my wrist, his toes were like mine and my father's, the second toe longer than the big toe. When we got back from the hospital, the epidural had not quite worn off, so Lisa did not have the full use of her legs and clung to me as we staggered up the front steps. Thinking of ourselves as a public spectacle, how must we look to the neighbors, drunk again, we burst out laughing. Once inside, the bleak humor continued. Anencephalic? All right, so he won't go to Harvard. It wasn't until I had settled Lisa onto the couch that my own legs quit working. I was in mid-sentence, something about an errand, tea kettle in hand, halfway between the tap and the stove. A spasm went through me. I doubled over and I heard my own voice howling from far off, the full-throated cry of a child. On the day I went back to the small college where I work, I felt myself in another kind of altered state, not above the flow of daily life, but just below its surface, heavy, settled, still. I'd been thinking about how to tell people, my colleagues, my students. Some knew that Lisa and I had been expecting a child. Clearly, I had to tell them what happened. Others didn't know about the pregnancy, though. Should I spring the whole story on them all at once? When a parent dies, or a partner, when we lose someone who has lived in the world, there are customs, worn paths to follow, ways to talk about it. But I didn't see any paths with this. Was I supposed to keep quiet and pretend nothing had happened? I couldn't accept that. So I typed out an email message, brief and plain, explaining Lisa had been pregnant, the child had died, and we took some comfort from the belief that all he had ever known was love. I stared at the screen for a long time. Then I clicked on the top of the email program and addressed the message to everyone at the college. Faculty members, students, staff, people I knew well, people I didn't know at all. I had a fleeting thought that this might be inappropriate, but then I pressed send. It felt like a form of protest. I wasn't really looking for a response. I just wanted to get the news out. I couldn't bear to repeat it over and over. And although my department's administrative assistant did field a few complaints about receiving something so personal by a general message, who is this guy? Most apparently understood, or at least excused, my gesture. And then came the outpouring. For weeks after, people I barely knew would come into my office, gently shut the door, and burst into tears. I heard stories of single and serial miscarriages, pregnancies carried nearly to full term, stillbirths. All the lost children. Grief hauled about and nowhere to put it down. Some said they had never told anyone. Who would understand? My first son is like the faintest scar on my skin now, nearly hidden. Over time, will the mark disappear as my skin becomes mottled and wrinkled? Lisa was planning to bury his ashes, about a teaspoonful, in the garden, part of which was to be his. Instead, she kept his ashes in the bedside table drawer, right next to her, as if afraid he would wake in the night and need her. She felt him close to her, a wisp of spirit, the smallest presence. When Benjamin was very young, just beginning to speak in sentences, he asked if he had a brother once. Lisa paused a moment before answering, but by the time she started to speak, he had moved on to something else.
Sterling K. Brown, reading David Loves' essay, My First Son, A Pure Memory. You can go back to episode 33 to hear how David and his wife Lisa moved forward from this experience. Well, congratulations once again, and thank you to all of our Emmy-winning Modern Love actors. We wish you continued success and, moreover, a return to Modern Love, the podcast. Next week, actor Catherine Hahn of Bad Moms and Transparent shares one woman's sobering advice to couples tying the knot.
At weddings, I do not contradict my beaming newlywed friends when they talk about how they will gracefully succeed where nearly everyone in human history has floundered. I only wish I could tell them that they will suffer occasionally in this marriage. And not only sitcom-grade squabbles, but possibly even dark night of the soul despair.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Siebertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins, CSA. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. Special thanks to the Television Academy for giving us permission to include segments of these acceptance speeches. You can hear them in their entirety at Emmys.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening.